enjoyed. Up next on Think, the Tony and Grammy-winning voice of Aaron Burr in the musical Hamilton, Leslie Odom Jr.
I want to be in the room where it happens, the room where it happens. I want to be in the room where it happens, the room where it happens.
We'll talk with Odom about why Burr felt like the role of a lifetime, about playing R&B legend Sam Cooke for a new movie, and about why he thinks failure has been essential to his development as an artist. Our conversation starts after a short break. If you wanted to understand what success looks like for a performing artist, a guy like Leslie Odom Jr. would be the ideal case study. He first performed on Broadway when he was still in high school, has had recurring roles in 9 TV and web series and parts in dozens of others. He plays Sam Cooke in the soon-to-be-released film One Night in Miami. And, of course, he won Grammy and Tony Awards when he originated the role of Aaron Burr in the musical Hamilton. So would it surprise you to know that Odom traces some of his most defining moments as an actor to his failures? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. For Odom, failure is not a cause for shame, but an opportunity for growth, an assurance that he is taking enough real risks to keep developing as an artist and as a human being. He wrote about this in a memoir published a couple of years ago called Failing Up, How to Take Risks, Aim Higher, and Never Stop Learning. And in this moment, when the streaming movie version of Hamilton has provided a real and welcome distraction from, well, pretty much everything, we are delighted to have him here to talk about his work. Leslie, welcome to Think.
Chris, I'm so happy to be here. That introduction, wow. I don't think of myself in those ways. So to hear, to hear it from somebody else, it's like it's the times that we stop and sort of think, okay, we have come far. I've traveled quite a bit.
You were not one of those kids who knew, like, from preschool that he wanted a career as an artist. Your first chance to perform came when a teacher, how can I put this, kind of saw through your nonsense and challenged you to put your energy into writing and speaking.
That's right. No, I didn't even know that it was a job, that it, you know, I think that, you know, they say an audience, the only responsibility of an audience is that you suspend your disbelief. You know, you go on the journey as an audience member. You believe that it's happening. And I was really good at that. Every TV show I watched, every movie that I watched, I believed that those things were happening somewhere. And I was watching them happen. So it's not that I thought that I didn't think performing was what those people were doing. So it's not something I was striving to do. And even when my teacher, as you mentioned, Mrs. Frances Turner was her name, fifth grade social studies teacher, even when she got me involved in this oratorical competition in the city, as you said, I was writing my speeches, I was delivering them as a little fifth grader, and winning the prizes were, it was money for college, savings bonds for college. You know, it's not, I didn't really connect that even to performing. What she got me in touch with was my voice. She got me in touch, even as a 10-year-old, she got me in touch with my little voice as a writer and my literal voice as a speaker, that I could stand up in front of a room full of adults and tell them what I thought, meant a lot to me, and was a, it was foundational. You know, it really, if you're doing that as a 10-year-old, if you're practicing that as a 10-year-old, you're going to, it's going to be easier as a 15-year-old and as a 25-year-old and a 30-plus-year-old as I am now.
Did you always know you could sing?
No, not at all. I mean, I don't think that I had anything special for a long time. It really is just about practice. The kids that like it enough to keep working at it can develop whatever they have. You know, we all have similar, I think, similar raw capabilities, you know, and not, you know, Bill Withers' voice is very different than Donny Hathaway's voice. It's very different than the instrument that Sam Cooke had. Those are all very different voices, but you can develop whatever it is you have into something that is more pleasing to you. That's the first, you're the first audience member. And if it's more pleasing to you, more, chances are it's going to be pleasing to somebody else. And so I think that, when I was 8, 9, 10 years old, my voice sounded like a lot of 9 and 10 year old kids. It was pretty, just what that is. But I just enjoyed it so much that I practiced and I worked on it. Gladwell, right, talks about the 10,000 hours. I put in my hours for that's for sure.
Do you believe, though, that you were born with a capacity that other people weren't born with?
What a great question. This, I love that we got into this. I don't think so. And when I, I'm very interested in teaching now. Here's what I'll say. When I was in college, we were a very small class at Carnegie. Six other people in my class, so seven total, and very different capabilities, or sort of not that's the wrong word. Very different instruments, like not everybody, we didn't all sing in the same way. We didn't all act in the same way. Now you must know the name Billy Porter by now, right? Okay. So Billy, I had lots of wonderful professors. Billy was the most effective professor that I had at Carnegie. He taught an 11-week class while I was there. And this is when Billy was at his low point. This is before the Tony Award, before the Emmy Award that he just won last year, and his own Grammy. This was when Billy was, he was at a crossroads. He had come to, he was, Billy graduated from Carnegie as well. He's part of the reason why I went to the school, because I wanted to be like Billy Porter and I wanted to be like Michael McElroy, these artists that I respected so much. And Billy was, he was in his early 30s and he couldn't get arrested in New York City. No one was hiring Billy. He was having vocal issues. He'd lost his voice. That was really tied to some emotional and psychological, an emotional reckoning he was having in his life, based on some stuff that had happened in his past. Lost his voice. Anyway, in those years, he started writing. He came back to Carnegie. He directed and he taught. And he taught this, I was a junior. He taught the seven of us as individuals. He was really the first teacher to do that. Everybody else was giving these prescriptive lessons, like this is how you do it, and this is the way that I want you all to learn, is the right way. This is the process to do it. And Billy was the really the first teacher to say, "Hey, Rory, hey, Griffin, hey, Leslie, hey, Angela, you are not in competition with one another. You are only in competition with yourself. And so I'm trying to get the best version of Angela, the best Angela Lynn, the best version of Rory O'Malley, the best version of Leslie Odom Jr." And so he, for the first time, I saw the seven of us. There were seven stars in my class. It wasn't the story that we've been told that there were one or two of us that was really exceptional and the rest were just okay. There were seven voices in there. Artistic voices that if you tap into the thing that you do, there's no one else. You have no competition. There's no one else that does that can do it quite like you. And so that's what I mean. I don't think that I was all I had, all I ha continue to have. The only thing that's available to me are the things that I do well. And if you want those things, there's only one place you can get them. But there's lots of other people that could have played Burr, for instance. It just would have been a different version of it.
Years later, Billy Porter helped you change your relationship to fear. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, we were so I'd started that relationship with Billy, and Billy was really, he was able to help me unlike any other teacher, because I will say I had gotten a fair amount of praise or confirmation that I had some talent, right, as a youngster. And so what that meant to me anyway, it doesn't mean the same thing now, I should say, but it meant it made me, I wasn't very trustworthy of teachers or professors in that, like, I had to, at that point, respect your talent in order to, in order for you to help me, I had to believe that you were, that you knew what you were talking about. You were the business yourself. I've learned over time, my maturity, thank goodness, has taught me that, that is not required, actually. Some of the best NBA coaches, by the way, everybody has coaches. Olympic athletes have coaches. And that is you need somebody on the outside of you keeping track of your development and challenging you to be the best version of yourself. Now, those people might never have been able to do what you can do with your body. That doesn't mean they can't help you be better. So I've learned the flaw in my thinking. But back then, that's what I used to think. And so Billy, I allowed Billy to help me. I allowed Billy to teach me because he was a hero. And so he was able to really get in there and challenge me. And I could hear it from him because I revered him. So he gave me my first few jobs out of college, and we were in Philadelphia, and there was this one moment. Long story short, Billy had written this particular role that I was playing. He was directing it now. He had written it initially for himself. It was a project he had conceived for him to play because no one was giving him any parts. So he decides to direct it, and he gives the part to me, which was, you can imagine, was humbling and scary, but really, I wanted to do right by him. Like I said, he was my hero. So we're in Philadelphia, and I had made the conscious decision to really make opposite choices than what I knew Billy would make if he was playing the role. Number one, because as much as I loved him, I knew I wasn't Billy, and I couldn't do it like Billy. If I attempted to do that, I would fail in a major way because Billy did a different thing, So anyway, there's this one moment deep into the second act of the show that I know what he wants me to do because I know what he would do. And it's if I can describe it for your listeners, it is just you walk to the center of the stage, front of the stage, and you tear the roof off the place. Nobody did that like Billy in, the early 2000s. His voice is different now, but you go back and you listen to those early recordings of Billy Porter, and you know what I'm talking about. And I don't do that. At least I didn't then. And so I was like, I'm going to make a different choice, an intellectual choice. Now, I'd had the same training as Billy at Carnegie, and so I knew I could make something else work at that moment. That would be unexpected and interesting, but it wasn't what Billy wanted. And so he asked me, I think weeks, he's giving me the note. I see what you're doing. He let me do a performance. I see what you're doing. Can you try something else? Will you just do the moment as written? I wrote this. Will you just come to the front of the stage and do something instead of nothing, what you're doing? And after weeks and weeks of him asking me this, he came to me frustrated and he said, "Listen, I don't know how to help you. You're not listening to me. I would love to see you do something else there in that moment. And, I wish you'd let me help you." And I got so frustrated and I said, "Billy, I'm not you. I'm not going to do it like you. And if I go to the front of the stage and I try to do it like you, it's not going to work. I'm going to tank the whole show, the whole performance. And I can't do it like that." And he said, almost with tears in his eyes, he was like, "Oh my God, I'm not trying to make you me. I promise you. But I know that you have a sixth gear. I know that there is more in there. If you would just trust me, I know that it's in there." So that night, I'm still livid. I'm enraged that he's even asking me to do that. And all fear, by the way. I go to rage when I'm scared. And anyway, the next day I'm so mad. I said, "I'm gonna go to the front of the stage and do it so hard that it makes him realize how ridiculous he is." The next day I feel the butterflies. I get to the front of the stage and I sail past 10. I go to 12, 15, 18, and it changed my life. He was absolutely right. I did have a sixth gear. And
All
I,
right.
I thank him again to this day.
My guest is actor, singer, and a writer, Leslie Odom Jr. We'll be right back.
Mother's name. When you came into the world, you cried, and it broke my heart. I'm dedicating every day to you. Domestic life was never quite my style. When you smile, you knock me out, I fall apart.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boy. That is my guest, Leslie Odom Jr., in his Tony and Grammy Award-winning role as Aaron Burr in the musical Hamilton. You know, that song really complicates Aaron Burr for the audience, doesn't it? He's this guy that we all know is going to do this thing we don't want to happen, displaying these emotions that every parent can instantly identify with. I would imagine everybody with kind of a beating heart is moved by that song.
I think you're right. I remember when I heard the song for the first time, because I had the very fortunate experience of seeing the very first reading of the Hamilton mixtape before I was a part of it. Hmm. It was up, they were doing a reading of it up in Poughkeepsie at Vassar, and Nicolette, my partner, was up there working. And so I happened to be in town. And so I saw this thing. And when they got to Dear Theodosia, this is after that brilliant opening, after My Shot, after Helpless, Satisfied, Wait for It. And then you get to a song like Dear Theodosia, and I couldn't believe that the same writer could write those, you know, those different styles of music so well. So, yeah, it was easy for me to love Aaron Burr because Lynn loved him first. You don't write a song like Wait for It for a character if you don't love them. You don't write a song like Dear Theodosia for a character if you don't love them.
Desire, like Aaron Burr's, is compelling, I think, because it can lead to greatness or it can lead to something really dark and sad. How did you make decisions at each point throughout the show about which hand to play?
Well, I made... Two things. Great question. I made the decision early to not get into a likability contest against Lin-Manuel Miranda, the most likable person on the planet. And by the way, like, you're also on stage with David Diggs,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, like, please, that's the captain of every team you've ever known in high school. I mean, David is, he's a prince of a man. Mm-hmm. Everybody loves David. And so you're not going to win any likability contest with those two guys on the stage. So I'm going to forego my need to be liked, because everybody has a need to be liked. As a performer, I come on your show and I'm like, I hope they think I'm funny and charming, whatever. You know, I'm going to let that go. And I'm going to settle for the need to be understood. I want their empathy. So I knew I wouldn't win the likability contest, but I said, if I do my job right, maybe they will put themselves in my shoes. I also said to myself, whether people admit it or not, there's a whole lot, there's going to be a lot more Burrs out there than there are Hamiltons. And what I mean is, you know, what Burr really is in that show is he's one of us. You know, he's brilliant. And, you know, he's also a lawyer. He's also a scholar. He's also a politician. He's achieving plenty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think about, you know, if any of those guys, man, you know, if Aaron Burr was ever looking down on me and what I do with a day, he'd be like, Jesus, you know what I mean? What are you doing? You're on Twitter for 2 hours. I mean, do you know what I would do with 2 hours?
Mm.
You know, I would have read and written, you know. So, you know, an impressive guy, but he's up against or he's living in the same time as an Alexander Hamilton, who is just one of the most formidable, impressive, aggressive, ambitious young people you'd ever meet. And so a lot of us, we've met people like that, and you marvel, you go, like, look, I'm just not cut from the same stuff, So I knew that too, that there'd be a lot of people out there, if you have to choose one, which one are you? Are you a Burr or you a Hamilton? A lot more Burrs than Hamiltons, whether they admit it or not. So there's that. But then also, my Old Testament and my New Testament for this show was Lynn's script. And then there's a book written on acting called True and False by David Mamet. And his whole philosophy is just that an actor can add nothing to my work. Do not impose yourself on my work. David Mamet says quite simply this: your responsibility as an actor is to make sure the writer's words are heard loudly and clearly. That's it. Period. Now, number two, after that, if my writing happens to stir something inside of you, don't deny it, don't block it. But if you don't feel anything, don't do anything. So that's it. I don't know if that, I mean, that I was just guided by those principles. Lynn gave me a masterpiece. And so I didn't have to come, I didn't have, there's not a whole lot of choices I had to make. The only choice I needed to actively make every day was to not get in the way of the story that he wanted to tell. And I had to make myself available. So what David is doing in that book is he's setting you free, and he's giving you permission. He says essentially anything that the writing stirs up inside of you, if it makes you laugh, if it makes you cry, if it makes you want to run around, do all of those things. It's just getting you back in touch with your instincts as a performer.
Were you at all tempted to go back to other sources of information, to the Ron Chernow book, to other things that you might have found, at the library, to add things to the character? Or do you think that would somehow diminish this particular Aaron Burr written for you by Lin-Manuel Miranda?
Oh, I read everything. I read everything I could get my hands on. My favorite gift at the top of when we were at the Public still, people would bring me books that they found in they'd order them online, or that they had in their libraries, books out of print about Aaron Burr. I have a library stacked. I've got about 10 Aaron Burr books in my personal library now that you can't find anywhere, so I read them all. And while I was at the Public still, I would learn a new fact, because a lot of the books, you can imagine, you cover the same ground. They're telling the same stories about him again and again. So you know that those are the truthful bits. And then the parts that you find, well, this is the only author that I'm hearing say that thing. So that's probably the opinion of the author. But I would every now and again, I'd learn a new fact, and I would try to incorporate that somehow in the performance. Okay, so now when I'm standing in the back, in the dark right there, somehow I need to be thinking of this one battle that's not mentioned in the show. And just for a moment, it started to weigh me down. The research started to weigh me down, and I realized that I was not on stage presenting a book report on Aaron Burr. No one was going to test me on all the facts that I knew. Most likely, in any room today, in most rooms, unless I'm there with historians, I am an Aaron Burr expert. I am the foremost scholar on Aaron Burr. So I already know more than most people about him. What I need to do is to show the flesh and blood. What I need to do is show the human being, the human in his being, as a performer, and so so I had to really set myself free from that. I wasn't upstairs. And Aaron Burr was born on his parents' names were, no one cares about that.
So let's listen to a little bit of your upcoming film, One Night in Miami, in which you play Sam Cooke.
There's no way I'm supposed to be this great. Look, Alexander the Great conquered the whole world at the age of 30, and I conquered the world of boxing at 22 without sustaining so much as a scratch.
That's right. Whoa.
There he goes.
You do the math.
All right. When is this party going down?
Yeah, that's a good question. What's on the agenda, Malcolm?
Well, I thought this would be a wonderful chance for us to reflect
on what's happened tonight. Like our young brother said, there's no denying that greater forces were at work.
You mean no one else is coming?
Oh, rest assured, my brother, you're not missing anything.
So just so people know, you're the guy asking what's going to happen tonight. There's not a lot out yet that we could pull from this film.
I'm glad you played anything. I think what you find, I love this little project so much. One of the hardest things I've ever done. But our dialect coach said, because those are pretty recognizable voices. Yeah. Sam's singing voice more than his speaking voice. But you have Malcolm in there. You got Cassius Clay, later known as Muhammad Ali, of course. Jim Brown and Cassius and Sam. And our dialect coach said, by the end of this, well, not even by the end. I mean, he said, what I really want you guys to find is your jazz band. I really want to be able to, because he wouldn't watch us. He would just listen. And he said, you know, I want you to find Sam's rhythm. I want you to find his tone, his, you know, what pitch is he playing against the rhythms and the tone of Cassius, the rhythm and the tone of Malcolm. Because based on a true story, Cassius Clay, young Cassius Clay, 1964, his first heavyweight championship bout with Sonny Liston. And nobody expects Cassius to win this fight. Nobody on the planet expects him to win this fight because Sonny had been the champ for years and years. And this kid, who is this kid? Nobody except Cassius, of course. He knew he was going to win. And so there's no victory party planned. He wins the fight. There's no victory party planned in Miami. And so Cassius spends the evening hanging out in a hotel room with his three best pals who just happen to be Malcolm X, Jim Brown, Sam Cooke. We know this happened because the gentleman confirmed it, but the FBI was also following Malcolm. So there's copious notes that you can find about the men that Malcolm is in there hanging out with. We don't know what they talked about in the room. That's what the film supposes. You know, the film takes a leap of the imagination and imagines what they might have been discussing all night together in that room. But, yeah, we were trying to find as performers, because most of the film takes place in that hotel room. Challenging, if you can imagine, a film all in this hotel room directed by the brilliant Regina King. But we were trying to find our jazz quartet in there. And I think we found it eventually.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So do you get to sing as Sam Cooke in the film?
I do. Which was one of the reasons why I ran from this thing for as long as I ran from this movie, Chris, like it was the plague.
Daunting, because, huh?
Yeah, I could not imagine why I would want to do that to myself, why I would want to make a fool of myself in that way. Sam is the blueprint. He's, you know, one of the greatest singers that ever walked the planet Earth. But it was Kemp's script. It was the conversation that these gentlemen were having. It really lifts a wall that, you know, the fourth wall is lifted in that hotel room, and we're having a conversation as four Black men that I've had the conversation very many times. I've had the conversation my whole life. You know, within my family, within my community, the things that we're talking about, but I've never seen them had publicly. These are not things that we generally talk about publicly. And in this film, it was daring, it was bold. Kemp was putting a few conversations that we have in this community, he was allowing us to have it for the first time publicly.
You wrote a song, an original song for the film?
I did. I wrote the original song, again, daunting, after a whole film singing Sam Cooke songs now. And now, Leslie Odom Jr. Sam is, because not only is Sam one of the greatest singers of all time, one of the greatest writers of all times. You send me Chain Gang, Bring It On Home to Me. And obviously, Change Is Gonna Come. So, quite daunting, but I I playing Sam with these actors, these extraordinary actors, my scene partners on this movie, it allowed me to, in a really wonderful way, love myself a little bit more and have a little bit more grace with myself, because it's not a perfect performance by any means, but I'll say this, I told you that story about Billy stepping into now at 39, there are young guys that call me, there's kids that think of me as a mentor now, and I pass on whatever words of wisdom and advice I've gleaned all these years now as a professional entertainer. And when I try to be as kind to myself in this performance as I would be to one of those kids. I said at first I tell you, Chris, after the first watch, I was ready to pick the performance apart, and you didn't do this, and what about this moment? And then I said, Leslie, what would you say if one of those young guys played, said, hey, Leslie, will you take a look at this film and tell me how I did? And I looked at that film and I'd say, and I had to be honest with him, I would say, not bad. That's about as much as I can give myself. Not bad, young man, And so I can have grace for myself in that way. And so, yeah, the original song, I'm proud of it. I'm proud of my work in the movie and all of our work.
Is film harder because you don't get to go back the next night and try something different?
It's harder for that. It's harder because so much of it is out of your control. Mm. In the theater, I realized early, Tom, we had an amazing director, Shepherd in Thomas Kail for Hamilton. But I realized, after opening night, Tommy is not there. Tommy goes off. He goes off and directs other things. And so I did over 500 performances as Aaron Burr. And when Steven Spielberg is here, when Beyonce and Jay-Z are here, whoever, when these luminaries come to see the show, when President Barack Obama is here, I decide what he sees. In film, you do what you do on the day, and then it's really a director's medium and an editor's medium. And so a little trickier in that way.
My guest is Tony and Grammy Award-winning actor Leslie Odom Jr. We will be right back. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is actor, singer, and writer Leslie Odom Jr. Here is a clip from a song called Seriously, written by Sarah Bareilles and performed by my guest, Leslie Odom Jr., on This American Life. The song imagines what President Barack Obama was thinking about Donald Trump and the 2016 election.
One man rewriting the book on bad behavior, maybe teach the neighbors, feels he gets what they pay for. We can't pat him on the back and send him on through. No man's ignorance will ever be his virtue. Is this the best we can be? Seriously.
How did that project come together?
It came from NPR. They had different songwriters and singers imagining songs from, I think, all the candidates in the election from their perspective. And I got a call from Sarah saying she had the assignment.
The song goes on to say, like, am I angry? Am I angry? You ask if I'm angry. And I wonder about the emotion you brought to the work.
I'll say, here's a wonderful thing, Chris, is like this moment that we've lived through, we're telling more truth to each other. I'm finding that in my relationships. I hope you're finding the same thing. I'm having more honest conversations with my brothers and sisters. I'm having more honest conversation with my white brothers and sisters, than ever before. And I think what the song taps into is just the reality that I'll say I'll speak as a black man if I can.
You absolutely may.
For the first time today, 45 minutes into our conversation. I don't know if I'm going to say this well. I've never said this publicly, you know, but there was something that we were taught about being about how we had to be the best. We had to be the most well-read, well-spoken, well-healed, but you know, filled with integrity and honesty. You know, that there was a certain kind of perfection, you know, that we had to be to achieve success in America, right? And that any problems that we were having as a people was because we didn't follow that example, right? Like if we would just be Bill Cosby, if we would just be Claire Huxtable, if we would just be, you know, if we could just be perfect, then every door in America would open and you know, it should be all good, right? Because these slights, this racism, this is perceived, this is about because you got to pull your pants up. And you have to stop, you know, with these ridiculous names, you know, all these things that we were told, right? And by, for all intents and purposes, Barack Obama, Michelle Obama, those children were that example. They were the best of us, an example of the best of us. And I don't want to speak for white people, but is he the best of you? You follow the best of us with what I would think, because I think highly of you, I think he's the worst of you. You follow the best of us with the worst of you. That is, I don't think there's a better example of the, the ugliness and I've never said this publicly, you know, you got me on a good day, of the reality of racism and white supremacy in this country than those two presidencies. As I said, I think we followed what 45, what President Donald Trump is able to do and get away with. I mean, can you imagine? Pick any one of the things that he's been accused of there's evidence of, you know, let's just pick Stormy Daniels. You know, this is nothing against sex work or this woman or any, but could you imagine the last president we had, President Barack Obama, being accused of knowing a woman who has spent her life, you know, as a sex worker. Could you imagine it? You can't. You can't imagine it, because there's no world in which it would be allowed to happen. Again, this man and this family, you know, we were told if we did these certain things that all the doors in America open to you and racism is over. And what we get is a backlash. You know, again, so the best of you, we can follow it with the we're going to put the worst of us in that same seat and show you, you know, that it doesn't matter. Your exceptionalism, your book smarts, your learning, your kindness, your attention to detail, your focus on what, being a good person, being a nice guy. None of that matters. You know, I just think it's sad and fascinating and all this stuff, you know. You tell me, do you agree, Chris?
Well, I don't talk about politics on the show, but I will say this. I will say this. I feel like you just decided to forget what you were afraid or told to be afraid of saying. You just turned it up past 10.
You think me in this moment, I just did.
Well, you talked earlier about Billy Porter sort of pushing you to turn it up past 10 and you got to this,
yeah,
this interesting place. I don't know. Maybe you don't feel that way.
No, I'm just being honest, you know, and I would encourage I don't hate nobody. I can say what I want. We can say what we want in this country, but I just, here we are, you know, thanks to Kemp Powers and this movie I just did and stuff, you know, and this, what we've lived through, this pandemic and all, you know, we got to be honest with one another. And I would love to hear from someone else, you know, I would love to hear someone that felt the opposite. Maybe I'd love to hear from that, but that's what it looks like to me. I said, you know, the best of us was followed by the worst of someone else.
Do you have any sense that any of your white friends or the white people you talk to are getting what you're trying to say?
I do. I think that there's a moment. I think that this has broken us open in a lot of ways. I also think that a lot of us are, you know, shell-shocked, and we don't always know the best way forward. We don't know the next right thing to do, you know, because the problems are all around us and they can be overwhelming. And so, yeah, I'm also met with that, with people just, you know, not knowing what to do. But I do feel as though we're talking to each other more honestly. And, you know, the Bible says, truth will set you free. And there's a certain amount of truth that we've never told one another before. So how free have we been in this land of the free? You know, we are telling each other deeper truths now than we ever have before. And so we are freer. That's the first step. We'll get to all of the rest of it when we get to it.
Do you have anxiety about the election?
I don't. I don't have any anxieties about much anymore. I mean, look at where we are. I don't know if America will ever be able to surprise me again. Hmm. I was surprised in 2016. I don't think that I see what America is capable of. And so, yeah, I don't have any anxiety, and it is not my responsibility as a 39-year-old Black man who inherited this country in the ways that my father and my grandfather inherited this country. It's certainly not my responsibility to save the soul of America. She's going to do what she's going to do. So I've got my one vote, and I'm doing what I can in my community to make sure that we get out and make our voices heard. And that's all I can do.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So we are in this very strange time where a lot of people in your business are sort of treading water, right? There's no stage productions happening in the traditional way. There's not a lot of, you know, film sets that are operational. What are you doing with this time?
First I was just, you know, there's been waves and phases. My goodness, I've been in this house for 7 months. So there's been movements and seasons. Mm. The first was just coming home and holding my wife tight and my baby tight and just making sure we were as safe as we could be. And we took the pandemic and the quarantine very seriously in this house. And we live close to my in-laws who are in the vulnerable population. And so we wanted to make sure they were safe. And so that was the first part just felt like bracing for impact, right? Like, how close is this thing going to get to us? And, you know, we just didn't know what's going to happen. So a few months later into that, I did eventually find a way to be creative again. I recorded a record in quarantine. My wife and I shot a TV show. We shot a Freeform came to us and they wanted to make a show about couples in the middle of quarantine, not a reality show, a scripted thing about what this experience was like with couples in quarantine. So we shot a show called Love in the Time of Corona. It's available on Hulu, but we're proud of the whole thing. You know, it was, as you can imagine, a Herculean effort, you know, following the protocols and stuff. It was the largest production in Los Angeles at the time we were shooting it. Nobody was shooting. People weren't shooting much, but we had extensive protocols we had to follow to make sure we shot it safely. Other than that, there's been some creation, but other than that, it's been a time of, you know, a lot of my life is about output. I talk a lot and I sing everywhere and I'm, you know, writing books and doing a lot. It's about output. And so I've taken this time to focus on input, because what goes in is what comes out. And so what am I listening to? What am I reading? What am I watching? To refill my well a little bit.
What are some of the things you're reading and listening to and watching?
Good question. Right now I'm reading a book because I'm very interested in, I just have some questions about mental health, mental wellness and mental health. We've got some, like most people, there's some mental health stuff that runs in my family. I just want to understand it a little better. I started reading this book that apparently everybody's reading called, I think it's called You Should Really Talk to Someone. Mm-hmm. You know which one book?
Yeah.
Right?
Laura Gottlieb.
Yeah. I'm almost done with that book, but I also went top of the pandemic. I dug down into Toni Morrison again. You know, there's some gaps in my Toni Morrison. I want to have read the whole set. And so there's still a few that I haven't read, but I read Beloved at the top of the pandemic. I watched The Sopranos top to bottom. I had never seen it. I'd never seen all of The Sopranos. And I'm in the movie. We did a prequel. David Chase wrote a prequel about young Tony. I had a really extraordinary time shooting that. That'll be out next year. But I the film came along so fast, I didn't have time to watch the series. So I watched that. I got around to watching last year's Oscar winner, which was Parasite.
Great. Oh, yeah.
So, you know, like everybody, I'm watching Last Dance finally on Netflix, the Michael Jordan doc. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
So damn good.
Yeah. And I don't even like sports, but yeah, it was amazing.
Great storytelling.
Yeah.
Great story. You know, and those were the stars of my youth, you know, so it's just, yeah, so fun. And then I got to say, you know, and then just like being a dad, like people take it for granted, but I travel in normal times. I would travel quite a bit. It wasn't unusual for me to be gone 200 and 250 days out of the year. So to be home, I've never, since my daughter's been born, to be able to read her a story every single night before she goes to bed, every single night, to make her breakfast every single morning. I've never done that 7 months in a row.
Actor, singer, and writer Leslie Odom Jr. received Tony and Grammy Awards for his performance as Aaron Burr in the musical Hamilton. He is in the upcoming movie One Night in Miami and the current series Love in the Time of Corona. What a pleasure it's been to speak with you, Leslie. Thank you for making time for us.
Chris, thank you. Thank you so much.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think, the podcast. You can find anywhere you get podcasts by searching for KERA Think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.